Yale Podcast Network.
Hello, and welcome to the Yale Law Journal podcast. I'm Nikita Lalwani. I'm a 3L, and I'm the executive editor for articles and essays at the Yale Law Journal.
I'm Ed Pickup. I'm a 2L, and I'm a first-year editor at the Yale Law Journal.
On this podcast, we'll be interviewing Yale Law Journal authors about their new and forthcoming work. We hope you'll subscribe as we dive deeper into current legal scholarship. Today, we're excited to be joined by Professor Sharon Jacobs, who will be discussing her fascinating new article, Statutory Separation of Powers. In the article, Professor Jacobs analyzes how the separation of powers inspires statutory delegations of power to federal agencies. Professor Jacobs argues that Congress constructs statutory schemes of separation, checks, and balances through its delegations to agencies. By better understanding such checks and balances, we can see how they facilitate resistance to the executive and how the executive might weaponize particular statutory entanglements in pursuit of policy dominance. The article closes with recommendations for how Congress, agencies, and the judiciary should act to preserve the statutory separation of powers as a meaningful safeguard. Sharon Jacobs is an assistant professor of law at the University of Colorado Law School. Professor Jacobs' research focuses on the impact of regulatory structure and process on policy outcomes in energy and environmental law. Before joining the University of Colorado, she practiced in the energy and environmental regulatory groups at Covington and Burling, D.C., and was a Clemenco Fellow and lecturer on law at Harvard Law School. Professor Jacobs, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Great. Well, to start, we thought we'd just ask, what is the statutory separation of powers? How does it differ from and how is it similar to the constitutional separation of powers?
Great. So the statutory separation of powers really is an idea that describes the kinds of delegations that we sometimes see to different agencies within the same policy domain. So like the constitutional separation of powers, it is animated by a desire to avoid the dominance of a single perspective or a single actor within government. But it looks quite different, and there are several reasons for that. One reason is that, of course, Congress is not limited in its design choices to the design choices made by the framer. So in other words, it doesn't have to divide powers between a particular number of branches. It doesn't have to divide powers along functional lines or formal lines. It has a wide variety of options, and it can get quite creative in how it distributes power among agencies and also how it creates checks and balances between those agencies. So rather in this paper, rather than try to define the universe of possible separations of power in statutory design, I chose to describe one in detail. But the options are legion.
How exactly can two agencies check and balance each other? You know, what are the mechanisms of constraint in practice?
So I actually do find that these checks and balances are the most interesting piece here of these delegation decisions. And I describe in the article a menu, if you will, of possible ways that agencies can check one another, can influence each other's behavior. So I'll just give you a couple of examples. I'm not trying to pretend in the article that this list is exhaustive. I fully expect that there are different and creative ways Congress has found to allow agencies to act as checks on one another, and that it will be even more creative in the future. But here are some examples. So one possibility is that Congress gives one agency a role in setting another agency's agenda. And the primary case study I use in the paper, which is the relationship between FERC and the Department of Energy, explores one such example of that agenda-setting behavior. So the Department of Energy has the ability, under the Department of Energy Act of 1977, to propose a rule or policy for FERC's consideration. This is a pretty unusual provision. I haven't found a lot of exemplars of this across the statutory universe. But what it allows the Department of Energy to do is control at least part of a fellow agency, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission's agenda, while FERC considers the proposal made by DOE. So FERC has to go through the APA's notice and comment process. If this is a legislative rule, it has to solicit comments and respond to them. It has to give a reasoned response. It's not required to adopt whatever rule Department of Energy proposes or any policy that it proposes, but it is required to consider it and to give a response within a reasonable time. And I propose in the article that if you saw Department of Energy invoking this authority more regularly, it could actually come to dominate FERC's agenda, probably in a way that Congress didn't foresee. But that's one example, is agenda setting. I'll give you one more, which is an emergency override of a particular agency's prerogatives, abilities, agenda, actions by another agency. So Congress writes into various statutes the ability for one agency to take over the tasks of another agency or tasks that are normally assigned to that agency during emergency periods. And we now have an administration that has been experimenting with the use of emergency powers in what I would think of as non-emergency scenarios. Of course, views might differ on that. But in the energy space, at least, we've seen the Department of Energy, we know this because there was a leaked memorandum that came out from the Department of Energy, has been considering invoking some of the emergency powers that Congress granted it to, I won't say interfere with, but to participate in the regulation of wholesale energy markets, which are normally under FERC's control and part of FERC's regulatory domain. And the statutes give it the ability to do this. So those are a couple of examples. We also see more common checks like veto gates, et cetera.
Great. Well, I'm glad you brought up DOE and FERC because we're going to want to dig into that history a bit later on.
I'm glad you brought up DOE and FERC. People don't say that very often.
Well, to stick to kind of just the broader idea of the statutory separation of powers, why does Congress seek to separate powers in this way? Is it about constraining the executive, preventing one agency from becoming too powerful, or something else? And how do we know that Congress is making these decisions, these choices, intentionally?
So it's always tricky to talk about the motivation of actors in government. It's one of the hard things about writing in administrative law and writing about structural powers, that we often have to make educated guesses based on what evidence we have. So I can't generalize about what every single member of Congress intends. However, my hypothesis in the article is that the constitutional separation of powers acts like a model or guide for members of Congress, that it's available to them as they're thinking about how to design delegations to agencies because it's a model that they're also familiar with. I'm not trying to pretend that every member of Congress has read Montesquieu. I think that probably isn't the case. But they're certainly hopefully familiar with our own constitutional separation of powers, or at least its rough outline. So my hypothesis is that that acts as a model for them, that when they're thinking about how they want to assign powers to agencies through delegation, their mind goes to the separation of powers, especially under particular conditions. And we can talk about that a little bit more later. But this might be a desirable setup within the administrative state for a couple of reasons, both of which I think you flagged. As we know, Congress delegates an enormous amount of power to administrative agencies these days. And within particular policy domains like energy, like healthcare, like the intelligence world, agencies then have broad discretion and a broad scope of powers. So one of the reasons that Congress might want to divide up these powers between agencies and set them up as checks on one another is so that we avoid a situation in which a single perspective comes to dominate a domestic policy space. One can easily imagine within the healthcare space or food and drug or environmental, whatever space we're talking about, a single agency, especially one headed by a single official, coming up with their own perspective, whether it's from the president or elsewhere, and simply putting that plan into action, such as the nature of the discretion available to the bureaucracy. So by dividing powers between agencies and allowing them to check one another, Congress ensures a kind of conversation between agencies. Sometimes those agencies may have the same perspective, but you're at least introducing the possibility that the agencies can deliberate or at least present alternatives as they come up with policy choices and action. So that's one possibility, and this is really in line with with the administrative separation of powers that John Michaels and others have written about, this idea that within the bureaucracy itself, we want to prevent any one actor from becoming too powerful. Now, he really talks about separation of powers between political agency heads, civil service appointees, and the general public as creating those checks and balances. I'm focused more here on the relationship between agencies as a whole. So that's one possibility. The other possibility relates to the constitutional separation of powers much more directly, and that is by separating powers between agencies, Congress might be able to provide some check on presidential authority. And this is especially true today as we've seen agencies grow and also have seen the president exert increased control over agencies. Scholars have been tracking this since Elena Kagan's article on presidential administration, and even before then. And we've seen successive presidential administrations use agencies and use administrative actors as tools to further their own policy agendas. So if the fear on Congress's side is that the president is becoming too powerful and too influential over the bureaucracy, then dividing delegations within a particular policy area between an agency that might be closer to the president or more subject to the direction of the president, like a cabinet agency, and an independent commission, which has a bit more remove from the president because of its structural features, Congress can ensure that the president will have a harder time, say, ramming through a policy of his or her choosing.
Under what conditions are we likely to see Congress wanting to separate power among agencies in this way? Is this something, for example, that's more likely when Congress and the executive are controlled by different parties?
You know, I thought that that would be the case. So certainly when Congress is controlled by one party and the White House is controlled by a different party, we're going to see most likely some conflicts of interest there. And so that might be one area, one set of conditions under which we'd see Congress trying to separate powers in this way. The primary case today used in the paper is actually quite interesting because Congress and the White House were controlled by the same party. We had Democrats in control of both houses of Congress. We had Jimmy Carter in the White House. And in fact, the Democrats had a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate, which is also quite unusual. And yet, we saw this separation of power. So thinking about why this example arose when it did, I think we're likely to see Congress trying to separate powers when there are conflicting forces acting upon it. So one force might be there is an urge, a desire, or a felt necessity to consolidate power somehow in the executive branch. And in the case of the energy agencies, I talk about this was true because we were in the wake of an energy crisis. And then this countervailing push not to cede too much power to the president, either because they're of a different party or because there's concern about the scope of executive power more broadly. The energy example I talk about took place in the wake of Watergate. And I suggest in the paper that actually some of the same forces are at play today with an urge to consolidate coming from the White House and also a concern about the concentration of executive power such that conditions may be ripe right now to see more of these separated and balanced delegations.
So you've mentioned a few times the case study that you elected to go with in the article, the separation of energy powers between FERC and the Department of Energy. Could you tell us why you selected that case study and what you tried to draw out of it in the article?
Absolutely. Well, first, let me just say I'm just so delighted that the Yale Law Journal is publishing an article on electricity and energy. It is one of those unloved areas of administrative law that people tend to shy away from because it seems perhaps too technical, grows out of utility regulation in the progressive era. And it really is one of the most consequential areas, I think, of policy today, not least because of its connection to climate change. But as an administrative law scholar, I've found that it is a productive area of study because of the constellation of agencies that we have. And as I was studying some of the interactions between the Department of Energy and FERC that have taken place in the last couple of years, I noticed that the Department of Energy has become much more forthright or much bolder about invoking some of these entanglements between the agencies, which had actually lain dormant for many years. So I got intrigued. I became intrigued by the connections between the two agencies just through current events, and then started to explore what its implications, what the implications of this relationship might be for the theories of delegation.
That's really interesting. And you mentioned the entanglements, or hinted at the entanglements between FERC and DOE that Congress created. What was the history that led to the creation of those entanglements?
So this was a structure that arose out of the Department of Energy Organization Act of 1977. And in the early part of the 1970s, the United States experienced its first genuine energy crisis of the modern era. Originally about oil, this was a time when OPEC was restricting supply, raising prices. This was a time when Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states were actually cutting off exports to America because of our support for Israel during the Arab-Israeli War. And that caused huge increases in gas prices in the United States. There were lines around the block for gasoline. And the anxiety that this country experienced, the idea that our energy supplies could be cut off on any front, pervaded our thinking on energy for at least the next decade, if not beyond. And so part of that anxiety manifested as a desire for more control over our supply. Energy independence is a phrase that you heard a lot around this time. And that was true not only for oil, but also for other fuels that powered electricity. And so what you had growing out of this was an effort by a series of presidents, President Nixon, President Ford, and then ultimately President Carter, to consolidate authority over energy policy in a single Department of Energy. And there were several bills proposed to this effect. The one that finally passed under President Carter was this Department of Energy Organization Act of 1977. And as I mentioned, the other crucial piece of history here is that we are emerging from the Watergate era. So at the same time as we have emergency rhetoric about the need to consolidate energy, and I think members of Congress were sympathetic to that, that we needed some kind of more global planning of energy around energy in this country, we also had a lot of skepticism about allowing the president to have virtually unfettered control through the Department of Energy over energy policy.
And today, what exactly do the Department of Energy and FERC respectively do? It'd be great if you could describe some of the checks and balances between them.
Absolutely. And it's funny, actually. So current Energy Secretary Rick Perry, when he got the job, I think understandably didn't have a full sense, and he admitted this, of what the Department of Energy actually does, because he knew about the piece where the Department of Energy does research and development. They're responsible for licensing on public lands of energy projects and a lot of the programs around energy conservation. But a lot of what Department of Energy also does is nuclear waste management and management of the nuclear arsenal. But to get back to your question, what does Department of Energy do? So primarily when we're talking about energy policy, it's in charge of the direction of research and development. It's in charge of energy efficiency programs and power marketing, so the marketing of power produced by the federal government. And then FERC is in charge of rate making. So that is, again, what normally makes people shy away from energy laws, this idea of how we set prices in wholesale electricity markets. It turns out to be hugely important from a policy perspective, because the way those prices are set and the incentives that are created will shape the market for energy and will dictate what our fuel mix looks like. But these are very different types of responsibility. And the Department of Energy, I think, perhaps understandably, might feel some frustration that it doesn't have a direct hand in wholesale energy markets. And so what we've seen is the Department of Energy trying to exercise some of these statutory entanglements to give itself more of a voice in overseeing wholesale markets and in designing what those markets look like.
That's really interesting. And you described in the article how these checks and balances have stacked up over time, how durable they've been. And you also argue that they've been tested under this administration, as you alluded to earlier. Could you dig a bit more into that and describe how they've been tested and how durable they've been?
Sure. I think regardless of how we feel about the political valence of some of this administration's actions, we can probably all agree they've been fairly creative in their willingness to upend existing norms, to try new avenues. And we see that in the statutory separation of powers context. So this is a Department of Energy that has invoked Section 403 of the Department of Energy Act. And this is what put me onto the idea for the article in the first place. So in 2017, the Department of Energy realized that it could send rules to FERC for its consideration. And the Energy Department sent over a proposed rule that would have essentially given additional payments to what it called fuel secure resources in wholesale energy markets. And it turned out that the only types of power generation that met that definition of fuel secure resources were nuclear plants and coal plants. Perhaps not a coincidence, given that the administration had already expressed vocal support for coal-fired power. So they invoked this entanglement, as I call it, to require FERC to consider this rule. Now, unfortunately for the Department of Energy, this was one of the most poorly supported rules as a legal matter that I've seen. And FERC simply couldn't have finalized it, even if it had wanted to. And so FERC ultimately decided not to finalize the rule, and that's FERC's prerogative. But you can then see through the leaked memo we had from the Department of Energy some of the frustration around that episode and the desire to invoke these additional entanglements, including the energy emergency powers under Section 202 of the Federal Power Act that the Department of Energy has, authorities under a separate statute called the Defense Production Act. How can we leverage all of these tools to effectuate policy? And this looks like a much more active effort to what I call weaponize these entanglements than we had seen to date, at least in the energy space.
Moving away from the specific challenges that have faced the relationship between DOE and FERC, in general, what are the challenges to creating a durable regime of the statutory separation of powers? I think in the article you discuss, for instance, linguistic ambiguity in statutes presenting a real problem.
So I propose that there are several problems with trying to design a separation of powers regime at the statutory level, or at least problems with designing one in any kind of detail, and especially problems with the evolution over time of that regime. So in terms of just setting this thing up, the Constitution is relatively straightforward. It was written at a time when we could design institutions from scratch. Statutory separation of powers does not occur on a blank slate. It occurs within frequently an existing universe of statutory delegations between agencies. And even here, where Congress was creating two agencies out of more or less whole cloth, FERC was the successor agency to an earlier agency, the Federal Power Commission, that had existing authorities under the Federal Power Act. There were a whole slew of executive agencies and offices within the executive branch that had various energy responsibilities. So for Congress to design a separation of powers that creates a rough balance between agencies or whatever balance Congress selects, it would have to know and understand what the existing allocation of powers looks like. And that's hard. You mentioned linguistic ambiguity. Of course, there are inherent limitations to linguistic clarity, and so that can make the balance on the ground unclear. When Congress uses a word like significant, so it says that FERC is allowed to review any Department of Energy rule that might have a significant effect on its own jurisdiction, what does that mean? Who gets to decide? And so that is another reason this is tricky. A third reason it might be difficult to do this ex ante is that some of the language is permissive in these statutes, so that puts the discretion with the agency to decide when and if to invoke these entanglements. Now, that might be how the system is meant to work, where agencies are supposed to invoke their own tools and their own defense in the face of encroachment. But in fact, in reality, we see that these tools are used, at least in the example that I look at in the paper, in an uneven way.
And just to follow up on the point you made about provisions that are phrased in permissive rather than mandatory terms, why might an agency choose not to exercise its checking authority?
So I'm going to invoke here an earlier paper that I wrote when I was just starting out as a law professor called The Administrative State's Passive Virtues. And it was using Alex Bickel's idea about the passive virtues in the courts to get at agency insecurity, the insecure position of agencies in our constellation of government. Agencies have no direct constituencies. They're not elected. Agencies are caught in the middle frequently between the political actors, between presidents and between the legislature. And agencies have a lot of masters. So agencies have to be quite careful about how and when they exercise their authorities, and that is true as well of these entanglements. And I posit in the article that we're going to see independent agencies be less aggressive in their invocation of checks and balances, partly because of structure. Mostly these independent agencies are headed by multi-member boards, bipartisan boards, and commissions, and therefore it's harder to agree on a single policy direction. Because they're more insulated from the White House, they're less likely to get a single edict coming down from on high about what actions they should take, how they should invoke these entanglements. So I think independent agencies are more likely to be reticent about weaponizing the checks and balances as compared with executive agencies.
Near the end of your article, you spend quite a bit of time thinking about how various actors can strengthen the statutory separation of powers. What can Congress, as the originator of these schemes, do to shore up the statutory separation of powers? And given problems like legislative inaction, gridlock, increased polarization, and so on, how likely are these solutions to be effective?
So one of the things I talk about in the paper, and this is something I think that scholars should be paying more attention to than we have to date, is the temporal drift of structural relationships within the government and what happens over time to actors and their relationships to one another. And so when the balance gets out of whack, which I guess I would define as it deviates from Congress's original intention, what should we do? I do think these relationships require maintenance, and Congress would be my first choice to rebalance, adjust, maintain the statutory separation of powers. As you mentioned, we don't always have this as an option due to congressional gridlock and other forces. I teach my environmental law class that Congress used to be really good at statutory maintenance. The Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act up until 1990, we saw regular and detailed amendments of those statutes, pushing deadlines, tweaking standards, adding specific chemicals to be regulated, and then radio silence ever since then on these two mainstays of environmental law. And we see that across policy areas. So I am not sanguine that Congress is going to maintain an active role in balancing and rebalancing the statutory separation of powers. And that being the case, there are some other alternatives. One is that the agencies themselves can do this. We've seen a lot of interest in agency entrepreneurship in the face of old statutes. But certainly agencies have the ability to invoke these authorities more or less vigorously in an attempt to fight off faction, right, to fight off the other administrative actor. And agencies can engage in a certain amount of what David Posen has called self-help in the constitutional separation of powers context. And then there are the courts. Courts are regularly faced with questions about how the authority between agencies should be divided, and it's usually in the guise of statutory interpretation. What does this statute say about agency X's powers versus agency Y's powers? So courts are being presented with these questions regularly, and I think my best general advice for courts would be have this framework in mind when you're deciding those questions. At least be aware of the possibility that Congress was trying to set up a particular balance of authority between these agencies. I would argue when we see a dyad like FERC and the Department of Energy with one independent agency and one executive agency, that the court may want to favor the independent agency for all the reasons I talk about in the paper and the greater risks of executive agency aggrandizement. And so it becomes an exercise in statutory interpretation, in understanding statutory purpose, in understanding statutory context, and what that means for interpreting particular delegations.
I want to go back to something you said about agencies. How can we encourage agencies to engage in more of these kind of self-help behaviors like the ones that you just described?
So I think knowledge is important. When I presented this piece to some government employees in D.C., many of them expressed surprise that these entanglements existed. I think over time, provisions like this can get lost, and agencies aren't aware of their presence and aren't available that they have these tools to invoke. And so especially for independent commissions that may not be on the lookout for some of these tools to leverage, I think that knowledge is power, and at least providing agencies with the option to use these tools in defense of their own policies and their own programs is important.
Great. And turning to the courts, which I know you just mentioned as well, I thought one of the most interesting parts of your paper was when you discussed the relationship between statutory separation of powers and Chevron deference. I was wondering if you could say a little bit about that relationship. Should agencies get deference to interpret the scope of their powers vis-a-vis another agency?
Yeah, it's such an interesting question. I'm teaching my statutory interpretation students right now. We have a class called Leg Reg at University of Colorado, and we're talking about when Chevron comes into contact with other priorities and other interpretive priorities, other structural priorities. And in the case of agencies defining the scope of their own jurisdiction, we have case law that says it's absolutely fine for agencies to get Chevron deference for interpretations of the scope of their own jurisdiction, because that's mostly what agencies do when we're talking about statutory interpretation. But this is a special case. Usually when we're talking about these structural provisions that divide power between agencies and set up these checks and balances between them, we're not talking about a section of the statute that necessarily is giving the agency authority to act. And so it's not classic Chevron in that the agency has been tasked by Congress with interpreting that section, at least not demonstrably. And so one possibility here is that there is no Chevron deference for these structural provisions, that courts are going to be the primary interpreters, like the major questions doctrine, like other doctrines that take the option away from agencies to promulgate their own reasonable interpretation as primary interpreters. This may be one of those cases where we want courts to take the lead. If courts aren't willing to go there, another option would be to favor the independent agency and an independent executive dyad as between those two actors, which is the actor that Congress would most likely have been delegating interpretive authority to, probably the actor with less inherent power in order to better maintain that balance.
Great. So moving away from sort of the solutions that you just spoke about, what further research do you think could be done in the area of statutory separation of powers?
So I think there's a lot to be done. As I say in the article, it can be unsatisfying to talk about ideas like this in broad strokes. I mean, I really do think this paper operates at two levels. It operates at the 35,000-foot level, talking about basic design choices and the way statutes are set up and this idea of the statutory separation of powers. But it also really gets into the weeds in this particular case study. And I do think that's the best way to proceed in examining statutory separation of powers is case study by case study, to look at the ways that Congress has done this in quite a detailed fashion in various areas of law. I also think it's important to do this at the state level. So that's actually where my research is going next, to think about the way that statutes at the state level set up relationships between state agencies. And then I think another area that this could be expanded into is that the president and at the state level, the governor, the executive does have some authority to create agencies. And that authority has been broader or narrower at various points in our history, depending on what kind of reorganization Congress permits. But the president could well play a role in what we would think of as normally as statutory separation of powers. This would just be administrative separation of powers more generally. But through executive orders, through the creation of agencies, the president plays a role in creating this architecture.
Great. If I could just ask two quick follow-up questions on that. One is, do you think that there's more to be said about the relationship between the statutory separation of powers and federalism? You know, you mentioned in the article the way in which states retain significant regulatory authority as well.
I think almost certainly. So when you think about the volume of writing that's been done on the relationship between the constitutional separation of powers and federalism, when you think about the literature out there on administrative federalism, I think there could be really nice ways to knit those together. I have to admit, in this paper, I am focusing almost myopically on the federal government, and that's not really fair in the energy space. When we're talking about which actors control decision-making over domestic energy policy, I'm only telling part of the story. Now, how aware Congress is of what the states are doing and the import of states' actions on energy policy, that I'm not sure. And I think that would be a fruitful avenue to explore when we're talking about design choices that are made by Congress. How well do they understand the universe that they're acting within?
You mentioned that you hope that scholars will pick up on additional case studies and kind of explore them in depth. If you could recommend one or two additional case studies that you would want to hear more about, what would those be?
I would be happy to. So I've always been intrigued by the relationship between the FTC and the Department of Justice when it comes to antitrust. And we've seen in the news quite recently a situation in which those two antitrust regulators disagreed fairly vehemently about whether and how to prosecute particular actors. So I think that could be interesting. My wonderful editor at the journal, Alex Mechanic, has suggested another possible case study that I told him he should do, and I hope he does, about the Federal Reserve, which is one of, like FERC, it's one of the sort of best insulated agencies if you look at several of the dimensions of agency independence. And the relationship between the Federal Reserve, other actors in government with control over monetary policy and other aspects of the financial system, I think could be fascinating.
Excellent. Well, Professor Jacobs, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
The Yale Law Journal podcast is a production of the Yale Law Journal. Thanks to Ryan McAvoy and the wonderful folks at the Yale Broadcast Studio for making this production possible. If you like the show, don't forget to share it and give us a rating wherever you get your podcasts.